this was the question that I had thought of earlier and saved till now. But when they were when they first showed up at the end of 13, obviously, David and Brandon making an appearance was not specific. But did you were you kind of consciously aware of those characters when you brought them back to bully Casey a little bit?
Nope. Sorry, fellas.
Oh, poor guys. Well, because we had all assumed that, you know,
just Joe's
Brandon
department?
Being the jerk it was done on purpose.
Nope. Again, Joe is central casting. You know, and it's very rare that I don't leave it to him.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Talk to him.
Eventually, you know, when Morning Glories can get its eventual other media adaptation and you have to pull in, like, Danny McBride and Bob Odenkirk, you know that the most expensive person to bring in is going to be Brandon, though.
Of course.
Of course. So here's something, you know, this issue is pretty heavy with the flashback, but there's something rather specific about that in that, you know, okay, we're looking at the Salem Witch Trials and you give us a date, you give us 1693. Here we have Chicago, Illinois, a different time.
Sure.
Now, Crit and I sort of debated what sort of time period it was based on, you know, she's got a Foster the People poster in, sure. in the background, so you know we made our guesses as to when this is based on when Foster the People was active, but why is there no specific time period for this one outside of a different time?
Does your entire theory for the book hinge on Foster the People now? Is
not entirely, but you know, we put it, we keep that, we have our own little timeline of references and things like that. So, you know, there's the one where Hunter's like, at least I got to see the end of Lost.
Sure.
We're like, okay, so the book takes place after that, but.
Yeah.
Well, really, I'm just wondering, is there a specific thing you're going for with a different time?
No, not necessarily. It was an issue of, I didn't necessarily want to spoil the contents of the issue 2 pages in. Most people tended to grasp straight away at the end of 13, you know, where Casey was. But there were a good number of people who didn't quite match up for, you know, that it wasn't quite apparent, you know, like at what point in the past she was at. So I didn't necessarily want to date it straight away. You know, there's also the issue, you know, that we see, you know, Casey as a little girl, you know, about midway through the issue. And if I'd put a year there, you know, if I'd put, you know, X number of years ago or what have you, you would have known that, you know, before the door opens. And I didn't necessarily want that, even not to say that it's a massively critical moment, but it's not something that I wanted to have ruined a couple pages in. Then there were also the issues of sort of, do you do years later there or do you do years ago? And in terms of the dates, while when we do this sort of world history flashbacks, for a lack of a better term for them, we put dates usually in terms of our character stories. We put X number of years ago versus now, and some of that is just simply I don't want to date the story too much. You know, it's not a situation where I don't want the timeline to be able to roll a bit in terms of comic book time, just because, you know, when we talk about this book going for 100 plus issues, I have to be very aware of how many years that's going to take. to tell it. And so I what I don't want is a book that feels dated before it's over. So I try to be a little careful on that stuff.
Mm-hmm. The other thing,
I don't do it very well just because I make too many pop culture references and everything, and that tends to date. But you know, Brian Bendis has a great rule, just always use Ghostbusters because everybody will always have seen Ghostbusters. you know, there's a couple times actually, like in issue 2, Zoe makes a Twilight reference, you know, and I always kind of look at it and think, not going to hold up so great in 20 years, is it?
You never know. Twilight is a pretty big cultural phenomenon, so.
Yeah, maybe it will.
So her father, down in the basement, and he is, you know, Crit and I kind of tried to get some meaning from this, but he is praying, and there is an empty canvas on an easel.
Right.
So, you know, obviously the him praying is probably a very specific choice, but is the easel as well?
It's not a terribly important moment, but I think, you know, how I always saw it was that Dan likely tends to pray before he paints. So, you know, that was my thinking in the scene.
So what you don't realize is that I actually just got you to confirm that the painting thing is important.
Well, the painting thing is, you know, it's something that we've referenced actually a couple of times. You know, one of the things we did way back in issue 4, we seeded a bunch of stuff in 4. And it's really funny because back when the first arc was going on, people kind of felt like that was the catch your breath issue to some extent. And actually, we dropped a ton of stuff that we come back to. And, you know, one of the things that we set up there is that, you know, that Casey's dad was a painter. You know, before that, he was in the military. And that he, you know, liked to show her things like, how to make tear gas. And, you know, we saw again in 13, you know, him teaching her to box. And, you know, these are things that by the end of this issue, I think made a little bit more sense. But, you know, it's a good example of sort of the way that we set things up, for down the road that maybe just, it's almost impossible, I think, to catch as a reader.
See, I had completely forgotten that there was any reference to him being a painter earlier. There's reference to it later.
Yeah.
But this was the one where I you know, I sort of noticed the canvas there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that was still confirmation that at least the prayer thing is rather important.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it may not be necessarily important in terms of you know, anything, you know, story-wise, as much as it is just, it's a little insight into the character that, you know, you tend to find that people who pray before they do their day-to-day job, you know, are probably pretty fervently religious people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's certainly something to keep in mind.
So here's an interesting bit. I've noticed actually recently, due to, and this is honestly something that I'd never thought of before. You know, in the previous issue, we had the crushing thing. And again, this is us sort of referencing, like, okay, when things are ostensibly related to the school and it's dark and it's, you know, murderous and wicked and evil, we've kind of taught ourselves to take it at face value as this is how things are happening. But when we see these same things elsewhere, when we see murder at a high school, it hits us harder. And here we have a torture sequence. Were you at all afraid in incorporating a torture sequence into the storyline at all? Because I've actually noticed lately, due to other things, that it's a much more of a hot button issue than I thought it was.
That's an interesting question. I would say a couple things. The first being, I think that one of the beauties of this being a comic, as opposed to it being in any other medium, is or particularly in television and film, we're allowed to get away with a lot more than you could elsewhere. I think, you know, we're probably never going to have, you know, parents groups breathing down our neck about some of the things that we've demonstrated, you know, or that we've shown in the book. You know, the second thing that I would say is I'm always a little conscious of, obviously, our cast is primarily made up of 16-year-olds. I think at least, yeah, I think you probably see more female characters than male characters in terms of camera time in the book. And of course you worry sometimes that, you know, you worry sometimes that a refrigerator case is going to be made against you, you know, that, you know, and we've certainly had our share of guys meeting Gorians, or you know, having a bit of unfortunateness come in their way. But of course, it's something that you keep in mind. You know, that you try to keep in the back of your head. But at the end of the day, it just can't dictate your story. You know, at the end of the day, your story is what it is, and you know what kind of needs to happen there at that moment. And really, for it to be a very harrowing moment for Casey, was the right thing to do, I think. So yeah, it's a tricky thing. You know, Casey in particular has really been through it in the course of the book. She's, you know, this is actually her second torture sequence.
Right.
you know, she's having a rough go of it. But also, I do think that we get held to slightly different rules. And again, this goes back to sort of pop culture language. You know, that in teen horror movies, teenagers are obviously fair game. And because we trade on that, I think we get a little more leeway. And you know, I also think that these things tend to counterbalance themselves if people can tell that you're sincere in your intentions, and people can tell that you care about your characters. You know, I mean, one reason why we don't get a lot of that stuff in regards to Morning Glories, I think, is because people recognize that we spend a lot of time investing in those characters and their stories, and so you can tell that they're not just there to be tortured, or they're not just there to be killed. So I think that saves us at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. With this, the sort of follow-up dialogue here between David Harper and Casey's father.
You love that, don't you?
I do. Well, you just wait. If the character that looks like Meg does make a return appearance, you're never going to hear the end of it from me. I'm going to be super all over that. But there's a thing here that's sort of referenced that was for what I remember, first referenced in issue number 6, which we never talked about because we only did the podcast starting with the second arc. But there's reference to the line is, well, we can probably presume the Chinese center.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, you've made a point that this entire sequence takes place in the past and isn't very specifically dated. But this sort of idea that there's a Chinese threat lurking, we've seen that in the book before with Jade the future Jade approaches Julie back in issue 6 about, you know, the project and asks if she's with the Chinese. So, you know, I know it's actually a real conspiracy theory that World War III is going to be fought between America and China. But right. Is there an additional thing you're hoping to seed here
for people like them? Not here. It's something that we've obviously referenced before, as you mentioned, in issue 6, and seeing the connection between those two is a great thing to take note of here. But beyond that, there's nothing else to really discuss right at this point in the story.
Okay, because for the life of me, I couldn't think if it was a specific reference to history or not, because I couldn't find anything that I didn't already.
No, it has to do with some of the same things that we dealt with in 6.
Mm-hmm. All right, so you know, as we go back to the future, Casey's mom referenced quote unquote that bitch Clarkson. You're talking about Kelly, right?
Yes, but weirdly enough, not that Kelly Clarkson.
Oh, all right.
So.
I really do like this sequence here, though, because, you know, when we were first starting out to do study halls, Crit and I, one of the very first things that we noticed and that him and I had talked about was the parental connection.
Yeah.
And that the only one who seemed to have a really great relationship with her parents, for better or for worse, was sure. Casey. And... you know, then immediately we got to see them dead at the end of issue 1, which was sad, but getting moments like this that sort of really bring that parental factor into it is sort of a nice way to remind, you know, the home that Casey came from.
Right. I really like writing Dan and Kathy, her parents. They were a couple of the first characters I ever wrote in the book. I wrote them before I wrote Casey, which actually, weirdly enough, kind of helps in terms of putting them in their parental role. They're fun characters, you know. They're a fun couple, and they're good people. And Kathy is, in particular, you know, so much of the story is, you can tell that Casey is a pretty severe daddy's girl, and you know, a lot of the story deals with her relationship with her father, but you know, Kathy, I think, is a fun character to write, in terms of she's a very sort of blunt person, and very, you can see that she's got like a lot of emotion, so yeah, I like writing them, and I was looking forward to getting back to writing them, and obviously they're a big part of this issue, and we saw a little bit of them in 13. You know, it's as you said, we have a lot of sort of dysfunctional families in this book, and a lot of people who have lost a parent or both parents, and it's nice to have sort of a strong mother-father duo in the book somewhere.
So, you know, let's jump ahead a bit and let's go. Miss Hodge finally makes her appearance, and right. Very immediately, the man she talks to is, you know, he's fairly familiar for anybody who'd read issue number 12.
Yeah.
When you were putting together the sequence in issue number 12, I can only assume that you knew all about the sequence in this issue already.
Yeah.
Is it something that, like, that you had to map out at all? Or is this basically just, like, you knew that you would come back to it, so you left that sort of undecided at the time?
Well, I think that these things are always easier for the person writing them than the person reading them or studying them or trying to piece them together. You know, so it wasn't terribly difficult for me to keep track of it, but it's been fun to watch other people try. I talked a little bit about this elsewhere, but I'll say it here too. One of the key things that I wanted to do with this book from day one is because it's a comic, and you know, one of the beauties of comics is that for the most part, you can assume that your audience is a very pop culture savvy one, you know, in a way that you really can't with TV or film. You know, with TV or film, there are lots of very casual viewers, you know, who are gonna come in and need things very spelled out for them and need to be walked through the rules of things. And one of the beauties of working in comics is there were very few people who read this who don't have some kind of familiarity with time loops and just sort of very, even if it's just sort of simple understandings of causation. You know, that if you've watched Back to the Future and you've watched Lost, you know, then you've gotten, you know, a couple decent primers on how these things quote unquote work. Primer actually is another example. There's lots of these things out there, and you know, when I get to work on this book, again, like I said a bunch of times in this conversation, like it's stuff that I get to trade on. Not necessarily assuming that everyone has seen those exact things, but you know, I know that the vast majority of the audience will have a working familiarity with certain concepts. And I thought about that literally the first weeks that I worked on the book and said, okay, this gives me a good opportunity to throw some other things at that audience. You know, because some of the popularly accepted ideas of what time travel looks like in fiction, you know, are not the only ideas that are out there. So this was, again, an opportunity to take advantage of past knowledge that the audience have and maybe do something a little different with it.
We'll actually come back to the time thing later in this issue. Mm-hmm. But for now, there's something that I want to... There's two things about this scene that I want to talk about. I'm going to go with the smaller one that probably has a quicker explanation first, just for the sake of discussion. But, you know, Hodge uses some kind of ability. She breaks out and gets to see Casey and sends her man drone here to go get a bag. And it strikes me as, you know, fairly similar that she has a bag prepared here for Casey, for what Casey's going to happen, as well as, you know, a previous person who may have also received a bag that was similarly prepared for specific occasions. Okay. Am I picking up on a connection here, or am I forcing one?
I'm sorry. Can you run through it again? Because you actually see my own time loops are confusing.
Did I lost you a little bit?
Yeah. Go ahead. Go for it one more time.
All right. I'll be more direct this time. So Hodge has this bag here for Casey,
yeah,
and it's got stuff to help Casey go on the run, basically, because we don't know where Casey goes off to. And in the last issue, you know, I had noted that it was kind of strange that Zoe receives a bag sort of perfectly packed for her with a knife in it.
Mm.
So am I seeing an intended connection, or am I creating a connection of my own because I see bags everywhere?
I had not really thought about the centrality of bags to this arc. Every bag causes new problems.
Yeah.
There might be.
Okay.
There might be some connection between the two.
So, the...
down in Central Packing. Academy basement is causing all kinds of problems today.
It's probably Pepe Sylvia down there. So the bigger part of this is that Hodge, in so many words, reveals that Casey has a power. I don't want to call it a superpower because,
sure,
you know, they're not mutants or anything, but It is a bit of a power. Is it probably a correct assumption?
Sure.
Because it doesn't seem like she's using the Force.
Once again, see, that's not who's behind the door. It's not Bilbo. it's Qui-Gon.
Well, the reason I bring it up is because I've noted it in conversations with you, and I've noticed
she's Qui-Gon Jinn. Star Wars reference.
You did.
That's depressing, right? It's not how it should happen.
It's not the worst one that you could make, because I like Liam Neeson.
Right.
At least you didn't say it's the fully grown and government employee of Jar Jar Binks or something.
Right. Right. Sure.
But I have noted in the past that it would appear that these kids, they have some sort of powers about them. I've said about Zoe in the past and what I believe to be her sort of not. Her dual personalities, as it were. And, I have some thoughts on Jade and maybe a precognitive ability that she could have. But now it appears that Casey, for all her leadership skills, has some sort of mind control leadership power. Is that sort of a correct road to be going down? Because I think there are no powers.
I won't answer that directly, but what I will say on this subject that might give you a little bit of insight is this. Back when we were first started working on this book and thinking about what we wanted it to be, one of the first worries that I had, and it ended up being kind of true. Is because it's a comic, and because the idea of superpowers and that kind of thing is just so prevalent in the medium. I really felt like if we weren't careful, people were going to be expecting at the end of the first issue, or especially at the end of the first arc. And I think that some people did do this. And I think that it's maybe why the way that the story has gone has been frustrating to some people. And I think maybe I can help with it if I explain it the best I can. I think a lot of people really expected at the end of that first arc that, around issue 5 or issue 6 when they were rescuing when they were rescuing Jade from the nurse's office. I really think a lot of people were expecting one of them to suddenly become invisible, or one of them to fly, or, one of them to shoot shit out of their hands or whatever. Sure enough, people expected it to sort of become Gen 13. Is what I always think of, that they expected it to be, all these kids find out what they are, and then it's about them fighting the academy, and they're on the run or whatever. And I was like, that book's kind of already been done, and it's been done probably better than we could, that's not structurally how the book works. The big moment isn't a sort of realization of powers or special abilities. Because I don't actually even think if that is a central part of the book, I don't actually even think that is how people would respond to suddenly being able to do those things. It's a superhero trope. And we come to accept it because it's a convention and it's something that we need to move our stories forward. But the reality is, if somebody flies tomorrow, they don't sort of take that as I can fly now. that there are a whole host of questions and fears and other concerns that that come into your mind, you know, if you were suddenly able to do something like that. And that, you know, we see the things that we do in the context of the world around us. So, you know, we wouldn't shake off our understanding of basic physics or of what we've sort of seen around us quite that easily. We'd start asking a whole bunch of other questions. So, in terms of powers or whatever, you know, it's probably not the best road to go down with this book to sort of say, oh, this is this person's ability and this is this person's ability, even when we talk in sort of direct terms about them. It's probably not how the story's going to play out.
All right, fair enough. So let's talk a little bit more about the time conventions here. Mm-hmm. Now, I think I read somewhere that you know, there are preconceived notions of time travel based on other examples of it, but that you have your own version of it. Is that correct?
What I'll say is I'm a nerd for this stuff. Like I'm kind of a time travel geek. Like it's just something that fascinates me to read a lot about. And one of the things that when you as sort of a layman start just looking at this stuff, one of the first things that I think everybody kind of realizes is the stuff that you see in fiction, you know, in terms of things like the grandfather paradox, are certainly popular ideas, but they're not the only ideas that are out there. And they're not the only theories that exist, and they're not the only possible explanation for things. So, what I wanted to do here was something that I felt was generally and typically unexplored in popular fiction. So it's sort of an attempt to be like, oh, you know what time loops are, and you know causality, and you know the grandfather paradox, you know, and you understand ideas like, you know, that timelines are perpetuating and would correct themselves. You know, or might correct themselves of anything essential, or you know these ideas. Okay, let's play with the fact that you know these ideas. Let's take them someplace else. So that's the goal. You know, whether or not we pull it off or not remains to be seen. But you know, at this point, you can't really do a grandfather paradox story anymore, just because it's well covered enough in popular fiction that you know, the audience is just too savvy of it. They're just too aware of it. You know, like the Terminator is just in their heads too much. So you got to come at them with something new. I think now to do a convincing time travel story. So yeah, it's an attempt. You know, we'll see if it works or if it backfires on us horribly.
Well, this issue I think has two versions, two different sort of consequences for time travel. One of them is obviously Casey talking to her father, and then somewhat trying to basically erase his memory of it. But we see that doesn't exactly work. Or rather, we see what I assume is that not exactly working. Mm-hmm. Because he has his moment when he looks up on the site and he sort of becomes conscious of what has happened.
Right.
So that is probably the first of the two of examples of you taking a new version at sort of a time travel trope, I guess, is that, you know, instead of, and we'll see if I'm getting the correct point here, but, you know, usually the thought is that if you go back in time and, you know, you do something like, you know, Marty McFly goes back in time and Back to the Future, well, the people in the future aren't aware of those changes as they're happening. Whereas here, it would appear that she's going back in time and changing something, and at the moment where this thing changes in her time, it has a reflective reaction in the future.
Well, again,
that might be you giving me too much if you answer that question.
No. I mean, what I'll say is what Lara says to Casey in no uncertain terms. She says, "You can change whatever you want." You know, that's a central, what I'll say is that's an important moment, just because, again, we are told so many times you can't change the past. You know, and Lara says, unflinching, without hesitation, without making a big deal of it, you can change it. That's really the key moment, the key rule in operation here. And you know, that Lara says predetermination is not in effect. So that's really the important thing to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. The other big thing here is the repeat sequence from issue number 12, which, you know, when we last talked about it, you know, I think I was super convinced that this means that Morning Glory Academy is in an underground facility.
Mm-hmm.
And now, under a new light, obviously, it's a little bit different.
Sure.
So is this, I mean, this is, we've sort of been dancing around it, but this is probably the big time loop issue that I think a lot of people are bringing up with the issue, is that it would appear that Hodge has to keep doing the same things forever, right, for all time. Right. But you're saying that that doesn't necessarily have to
that
be the case.
That she goes, I'm not saying anything. but if you were thinking about this in terms of the way that you know, we've been sort of taught, mm-hmm, usually through pop culture, unless, you know, we did like heavy training in physics, you know, mostly we get the stuff from our pop culture, and it says that now Lara is in a loop, that she goes from this underground scene to the school, back in time to the events with Casey, and then back to here, and that's a full circle. Yeah, but we know that can't really be the case, because unlike a compass or, you know, something along those lines, you know, we've seen Lara in other environments, right? We've seen her at other times. You know, does not compute, right?
Mm-hmm. So is it possible, and, you know, you can feel free to just choose not to answer, is it possible that if time can be changed in any way that Casey wants, that time can similarly be changed in any way that Lara wants, and that as she goes through this portal here at the end of the issue, since we don't know where she's going, she could be coming out at a completely different place and time that she wants to be at.
Maybe so. It could all just be trickery. yeah, it's well, we know from this issue that Lara can do the things that she tells Casey to do. You know, that Lara, in fact, can tell people to do things or whatever, and they do them. You know, so we know that whatever applies to Casey here applies to Lara.
Mm-hmm. So as we move to this final page, you know, there's two things I think that are probably pretty noticeable about it. The first is that person in the first panel here looks possibly familiar.
It's not.
It's a nobody.
And again, this kind of goes back to, we talked about this earlier, you know, there's a trick of there's only so many kinds of faces, and you know, that a lot of times confusion in this book comes from, you know, people being convinced that you know, white guy with brown hair is that other white guy with brown hair, you mm-hmm. know, like, and it's just, yeah, it's nobody else on this page is anybody familiar.
We need to come up with a name for that effect. Like, I kind of just want to call it the light in the tunnel.
Yeah.
So the other thing is that it would appear, you know, for all intents and purposes, that, you know, I said this before, even in the study hall, because it's, you know, it's what I have in my notes, that you appear to have written Casey out of the book for a bit.
Yeah. So there goes our lead.
That's what I was going to say. You know, everybody has these assumptions about who she is, and now, you know, I don't think anybody can put a good guess as to when we're going to see her again. But is it safe to say that we probably won't see her for a while?
I'm not going to say either way.
That's fair.